welcome to By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Eugene Perrier, and as always, we're your guide to connecting the political, social, and economic movements shaping the world around us. And later in the show today, we're going to be joined for most of our program by Reverend Lennox Yearwood, the president and CEO of the Hip Hop Caucus, about social movements in America and a little of what we saw in 2016 and what we can expect moving forward in 2017. But before we can move on, one more time before the holiday, I just have to say something again about this ridiculous and absurd idea of a corporate tax cut for repatriated profits, a tax holiday, if you will. This issue came up once again yesterday afternoon as Tim Cook, the CEO of Apple, confirmed that one of the topics that he discussed with Donald Trump, which was quite important to Apple, was this idea of a tax holiday. And the issue at stake here is the alleged $2.6 trillion that major corporations have overseas. And for your information, the top five corporations in order of overseas cash holdings as of September 30th are Apple with $216 billion, Microsoft $111 billion, Cisco $60 billion, Oracle $51 billion, and Alphabet Inc., the new parent of Google and related companies, $48 billion. And as we've reported before, though, it's a little bit misleading, the dollar amount that is. Only about $1 trillion is in cash. The other $1.5 trillion has been reinvested in those companies' operations abroad and is not available to be repatriated. Either way, it's a bunch of money. So corporations and politicians say that this is all good because they're going to put the money to work. And in fact, this has been part of the speculation for the past several months here around how Trump is going to put together his infrastructure plan, that this repatriated cash from overseas and the tax holiday, the taxes on that and maybe some investments on that can combine together to help create the money for this big infrastructure push. The other issue, though, is the chances of that actually happening are extraordinarily low, and the evidence we actually have from the past backs this up. So during the Bush administration, we know that they did, in fact, do this. And in the bill they passed to have this tax holiday and bring the money from overseas, it actually said in the bill that they had to use it to invest in jobs, not stock buybacks and the like. However, when the money came back after the law went in, the businesses did exactly that and mainly used the cash to buy back stock and pay out dividends. And some of them even laid off workers after getting the money back. And of course, no one ever did anything to hold them accountable for breaking the law, at least the spirit, if not the letter. And just recently, someone asked the CEO of Cisco Systems, Chuck Robbins, what he would do with this money if he could bring all that cash back at an ultra-low tax rate, maybe even as low as 5%, although Trump's talking about 10. And his response was, quote, "We do have various scenarios in terms of what we do, but you can assume we'll focus on the obvious ones, buybacks, dividends, and mergers and acquisition activities," end quote. So I decided, since Tim Cook was going to come out, make another big deal of this yesterday from Apple, I was going to take a look at what Apple was doing and see how likely would it be that Apple would actually invest this, or would they, in fact, go ahead and do another share buyback situation. So right now, Apple claims at current tax rates, they'd owe about $60 billion on the money they've stashed overseas if they bring it back. Trump is saying that he would allow people to repatriate the profits at a rate, tax rate could be about 10%. So that means that Apple will probably save somewhere between $40 and $50 billion. Now, what we also know is Apple is one of the most aggressive share buyback companies, and this is because Apple's sky-high growth rates are probably, not going to keep going this way. And so to give investors the return they want, they keep buying back this stock, so that way people get the return they want. That is the money they want back from it, and then people keep investing in the company, even though the company won't grow at the same rates that initially caused it to be such a stock market sensation. I looked at their fourth quarter financial report that came out not too long ago, and that report noted that in April of 2016, they had increased the ceiling on share repurchases to $175 billion from the previous $140 billion, and I think they've used about $133 of that. So ultimately, there's about $40 billion that has not been used that they could use potentially in money they would get to repurchase more shares in 2017. So in other words, there is an almost exact match in terms of the money they would save from taxes repatriating this cash to the amount of money that they say they will spend on share buybacks. So once again, proving that these tax holidays won't create jobs, but will just enrich people on the stock market who are already super rich, just like they did when it happened in the Bush era. So it's going to be a massive tax windfall, enriching big-time investors, not helping finance new bridges and roads. Fool me once, shame on you. Fool me twice, shame on all of us. Despite a fairly widespread expectation that a special session of the North Carolina legislature would repeal the anti-transgender HB2 or bathroom law, the session instead descended into chaos and the law was not repealed. Really, the entire North Carolina political scene now has turned into an immense car wreck. From the massive attempts at voter suppression to the controversy over HB2 to the gutting of the incoming governor's powers in an unprecedented way, North Carolina has been front and center of the political news all year long, and ultimately the state seems split almost totally in half by partisan rancor between the left and the right, and proxy battles in just about every important political struggle have taken place in that state. As it concerns HB2, the law outraged the country as it sought to discriminate against transgender people and caricature them in the most offensive ways, painting their rights to use bathrooms that conform to their chosen gender into some sort of gateway drug for pedophiles and rapists. It even went further than that, banning localities from enacting protections for LGBTQ people under their jurisdiction. The NCAA removed 7 championship events from the state, and businesses like PayPal scrapped plans to expand their business in the state, dealing a blow to North Carolina that was one of the more rapidly growing states economically in the South. The repeal seems to have failed really on the basis of petty politics by Republicans who at the last second tried to attach an amendment to the bill that would have called for a 6-month cooling off period where no localities could pass laws that restored rights lost under HB2. Democrats who represent those areas that would pass such laws in their part of the state were obviously outraged. And Republicans then tried to claim, well, no, it's not really on us. It's the Democrats' fault because the city of Charlotte didn't repeal its ordinance that challenged HB2 in a way that pleased them. Not that they didn't repeal it, but that they didn't do it in the right way. Clearly, there was never any real desire for the law to be repealed by Republicans, but it had clearly hurt the prospects of the state economically, and they had been forced into a corner. Anger at Democrats in Charlotte was just an easy thing to seize on to refuse to repeal the bill. HB2 should be repealed, and North Carolinians are only suffering because legislators are pushing through the agenda of billionaire Art Pope and his hate-mongering right-wing political network, as opposed to seeking to provide basic civil rights to all their citizens. Donald Trump's nominee for Secretary of Labor, Andrew Pudzner, wants to replace you with robots. He said earlier this year that robots are, quote, always polite, they always upsell, they never take a vacation, they never show up late, there's never a slip and fall or an age, sex, or race discrimination case, end quote. And in fact, in his industry, fast food, robots are already making inroads. Everything from automated sushi makers to machines that can flip hundreds of burgers at a time are starting to make their debut at restaurants across the country. And a newly released report from the White House shows that, in fact, it is a pretty big deal. That is, robots taking your jobs. The report notes that millions of jobs will be lost to robots, and no one knows exactly how many, but reports range from 9% to 47% of current jobs could become automated over the next 20 years. A big difference, but still pretty notable if 9 every 100 workers permanently lost a job to technology on the low end there in the next 20 years. And while technology is not in and of itself bad, the problem in this kind of structural unemployment is very real, which is why we've seen the employment to population ratio in this country continually go down. And in fact, this has historically and continues to be one of the primary arguments by socialists, for instance, as the only way to create enough productive labor is to control investment and employment by the whole society rather than a handful of billionaires, and to prioritize everything from science to education as flipping burgers and building cars becomes something that machines increasingly do. The point being, the capitalism operates under a profit motive at all time, and to really restructure society for full employment, many things that are indeed great but not profitable would have to be ramped up, as would their support system. Trump and Pudzner, though, are not socialist. They are capitalist, and they will clearly put you out of work and then just increase the number of cops and prisons to contain the social fallout for the growing millions with no jobs and limited to no social services. So I guess if you want a newer, better, cooler job that you like more after robots steal the one you have now, you better become a socialist. Texas is now moving to block Planned Parenthood from being a part of that state's Medicaid program. And the basis for this is the smear campaign against Planned Parenthood for allegedly selling fetal tissue. Despite the fact that no legal authority has found Planned Parenthood did anything wrong, the state of Texas is still trying to claim that they broke some law and as such, keep them out of the state's Medicaid program. They did get about $3 million from that last year. Attacks on Planned Parenthood are a key part of the hard right anti-women's choice movement. As one of the largest providers of women's health care services and one that is quite well regarded, delegitimizing and smearing Planned Parenthood is a key aspect of in the overall struggle to try to ban abortion. By making entities that provide, among other things, abortions appear to be shady and unethical, it aids the viewpoint painted by so-called quote-unquote pro-life forces that abortion is morally and ethically wrong and thus anyone engaged in it must be morally and ethically compromised. This move by Texas could very well fail and is before the courts, but these attacks are as important for the narrative they create as the ultimate outcome. 2017 is likely to be a monster year for assaults on women's rights of all kinds, so doing what we can to control the narrative will be key. And those are today's talking points, and you are listening to By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Eugene Perrier, and as always, we're your guide to connecting the political, social, and economic movements shaping the world around us.
By any means necessary.
And here with us to expand a little bit on some of these topics is Bob Schlehuber, a Sputnik news analyst. Bob, thanks for joining the show.
As always, my pleasure.
What are you thinking? Some of the initial thoughts about Apple claiming they want to help build roads, but really just looking to put money in big investors' pockets.
I was looking up some stats here on my iPhone, and you know, I jokingly say that.
Nice.
But as I was looking it up, I mean, 50% of households in America have an Apple product. And I don't think we really realize that we're complacent in what our U.S. companies do abroad, not only in the money that they earn and how they establish their businesses, but also looking at how they actually have a corporate responsibility. I mean, this big story a couple of years ago was Apple and their conflict minerals, right? The tantalum, gold, tin, and tungsten, which were pulling out of Middle Africa and all these different countries. And so these companies are abroad. They carry the United States' name. And so on one end, they're not having to pay taxes. They're not having to reappropriate this money. But then they get the credibility of the U.S. business abroad to build their empire. And that comes with all of the marketing benefits. That comes with the free range that you have as an American passport holder around the world. And I don't think these companies are really reeled in. And I don't think people realize how complacent we are towards their actions. And so I think the tax and holding them accountable to not only the taxes, but also their human rights responsibilities around the world. We learned a little bit more about this earlier this week with the Holy Land Principle saying, hey, you know what, if Americans are going to own these companies and they're doing bad things abroad and they're not being responsible to taxpayers, then we can reel them in as we own shares in these companies. I mean, these are publicly traded companies. Obviously, it favors the wealthiest of the wealthy that can own the bulk of those stocks. But it shows that something can be done. And I think we need to see more efforts by people and by the owners of these companies to pressure these companies. Because government, like you're saying, they're not going to pressure companies. They're not going to have any sway over Apple or Google or Alphabet to do anything. And as long as they're giving huge political donations every year, they're going to continue to get away with it. So if we want to see any of the things you're talking about be addressed, obviously we're not going to see it within the Trump administration, just like we haven't seen it over the last 8 years with the Obama administration.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, I think that's just – it's the name of the game. And, you know, perhaps maybe the one sort of subsequent positive here is maybe ripping the veil off of Silicon Valley as like a supposedly – you know, progressive bastion or something like that. They've got a lot of their own problems. But that being said, another big problem, HB2. I don't know how you're looking at this. I mean, I guess a lot of people thought that they were definitely going to repeal this and it was going to be a quid pro quo because of what they did to take out the governor's power. Charlotte was going to remove their ordinance and then people were going to go to sort of a live and let live attitude towards these ordinances. There just wouldn't be a state level ban or protection. Your thoughts on how this is playing out?
It's just interesting. We got to remember that 23 states filed lawsuit against the Obama administration for putting pressure on them to repeal these HB2 laws. It's not just North Carolina. North Carolina, obviously the one that's aggravated it and driving it more than anyone. But I think a story that's going to play out continuously throughout 2017 is local municipalities trying to pass their own laws against states' rights against federal rights. I mean, we saw John Kasich today.
States' rights.
John Kasich is denying any city's effort to raise the minimum wage above the state of Ohio.
Wow, the moderate.
So there you go, the moderate, working in the middle, keeping that below $10. I mean, the Cleveland was trying to pressure a $15 minimum wage, and John Kasich says, well, I'm the governor. I have a state's right. I'm going to implement that over the city. Cities are going to push back against the federal government. I think it's going to be a more challenging than we've ever seen between the city, states, and federal. I also want to say
– let me ask you this though, because I think that's a relevant point. I mean, is that maybe a subtext of 2016 that sort of the democratic structure of America is under maybe more strain than it's been in some time?
I think so. And the kind of conversation around superdelegates and the electors having the say is like who actually rules people and who actually has the power to pass these laws? And I think we're seeing that strain between the representational democracy that we have and kind of the democracy people think we have, where their individual votes actually get them something when it's not. And the other thing that was interesting that kind of speaks to states' rights and what individual states can do is thinking about Reverend Barber calling now today for a boycott of North Carolina, continue the boycotts there. But then you saw Andrew Cuomo earlier this year, the New York governor, saying anybody that any business in New York that puts a boycott, divestment, or sanction plan into action against the state of Israel, then the state of New York is going to boycott them. So would we see something weird where North Carolina calls for boycotts against anybody that has transgender bathroom or just has bathrooms that are normal and people aren't weird at their company? Is like North Carolina able to wield their own political power when it comes to these boycotts in response?
Yeah.
I think that's also an interesting threat here. And we'll see if the people of North Carolina are pressured. I mean, these boycotts and sanctions ultimately have a big impact on just the everyday people there that are liberal or Democrats or progressives that don't want to see these bathroom laws go into effect. So then the boycott has its own kind of gray area of who it actually pushes into action. And so it'll be interesting to see how this story plays out.
Are you worried that your job as Sputnik News analyst could potentially be replaced by a robot that also knows many things? Sort of like Watson in Jeopardy. You're in trouble.
Wait, is that possible?
Yeah, I mean, it destroyed all Jeopardy comers. Watson is not a game. Watson is the singularity is coming.
It'll be interesting to see what jobs actually get taken. I think we kind of rush to think of the obvious jobs that you talked about in your opening that will get automated. But I think lawyers are really concerned too, because if you can do legal review and
there's that guy, the guy in London who I think is in New York who does the traffic tickets. It's a robot that does traffic tickets, and it wins a lot of the time.
Yeah, and often we don't see and we can't predict the evolution of technology, because what we think it's going to be intended for can often shift rather quickly. And so all of a sudden, say like lawyers, the field completely goes obsolete because you replace enough of them and other people already are moving away from the law field. Like what fills that gap all of a sudden? I think the robots hanging the jobs thing will also hopefully push critical conversations about what it means to work, as well as what it means to be paid or compensated. If we'll see something like, hey, we don't need all these jobs and no longer do we need everybody working a 9-to-5, 5 days a week, but maybe we need people working 25-hour weeks on 3 days of the week. Well, what do they do with those extra 2 days? And what do they do for pay? And how do we reconsider and think about that? So, yeah, I mean, talk about a story that we're not going to – we'll be more and more surprised as it evolves moving forward.
Mm-hmm. Texas trying to take out Planned Parenthood. It seems like we'll see more of that coming up as well in 2017.
Yeah, I think across the board, we've already seen more and more local and state fights. Going back to what I was saying, that I don't know if we're going to be able to – if that many pro-life cases will ultimately win. I really do hope there's a national infrastructure and enough Supreme Court laws that are in place that will be able to put that pressure back. But I think you're going to see so many Planned Parenthoods and pro-choice groups on the defensive, where they're just constantly having to fight off a minority of very loud, emboldened pro-life religious conservatives.
Yeah, I mean, like, where's the, at the pro-life marches, where are the signs against, like, the war in Yemen, you know what I'm saying, and people being killed and with cluster bombs and weddings, quote-unquote
pro-life? Or just the basic health of the mother in situations where people are willing to risk the health of a mother and to avoid the abortion. And who doesn't want their who's not pro-life at the end of the day? Everybody that's pro-choice is ultimately pro-life.
I mean, obviously, James Mad Dog Mattis, the defense secretary, who said it's fun to shoot people,
yeah, there
not
you
pro-life.
Go. There you go. I mean, all these internal contradictions that we have. Again, we can criticize Apple, but we all own Apple products. Again, we all can criticize religious freedoms.
I'm very upset about that.
I mean, all of this stuff. I mean, it's just these internal contradictions. So, yeah, I mean, that fight for pro
something there.
Choice people over the next few years.
Well, anyway, I appreciate you, Bob. Hopefully you will not be replaced by a robot in the new year. We are
going
to take a break here on By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Eugene Perrier. Stay with us.
By Any Means Necessary.
Welcome back to By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Eugene Perrier, and as always, we're your guide to connecting the political, social, and economic movements shaping the world around us. And And today we are talking a little bit about what we can take from 2016 into 2017 as it concerns moving this country in a more progressive direction. And we are very, very happy to be joined here on the show for this conversation by the Reverend Lennox Yearwood, who is the president and CEO of the Hip Hop Caucus. Reverend Yearwood, thank you so much for joining the show.
My brother, it is a pleasure, and I mean a pleasure to be with you today.
Well, the pleasure is all mine, and I think the place to start is maybe 2016, kind of a contradictory year. I mean, obviously, we had Trump win there at the end, which was not a good look, but we've seen a big victory at Standing Rock, some other social movements putting in work. So it seems like sort of a contradictory time. I mean, on the one hand, people's movements are clearly growing, but on the other hand, like the far, far right, they feel like they're riding pretty high in the saddle, too. So maybe some of your main takeaways from 2016 is the place to start.
I mean, the main takeaways for 2016 is, you're right, it is a mixed bag. You know, on one hand, Donald Trump is the president-elect, and now with the Electoral College, will become president on January 20th next year. And it isn't so much that he was elected, but how he was elected. I think that he was elected by, you know, spreading fear. He was elected by having rallies where he talked about people who weren't primarily white in a way that kind of stroked fears. He bashed those who were Muslims. He bashed those urban communities. He bashed women. He bashed everything regarding progressive issues, issues regarding climate change, health care, education. And he did it in a way which went back, as he said, you know, how to make America great again. He did it in a way in which he literally took America back to a time. But what people should know about the Trump candidacy is that it's not new. What's interesting is how much he copied literally almost from the playbook of Richard Nixon. And so when Richard Nixon was running for office against Humphrey, which who was at the time a candidate very similar to Hillary Clinton. It was somebody who really, those of us who were progressives at that time was saying that it was, you know, not strong enough against the war, not strong enough regarding civil rights, allowing, you know, when people talk about black power, was very much kind of not as strong as could be, but was the establishment of the political left, so to speak. And what Nixon did then was Nixon came up with the law and order, stoked fears, talked about how America can go back, about how we have, you know, at that time, Martin had just been killed. And so, you know, the riots in the streets and so the same kind of thing that Nixon did. And then, in essence, people who were kind of seen as the lesser of two evils, well, Nixon and Humphrey, you know, don't really matter, backed away. Nixon won. We got COINTELPRO. A lot of things happened. And then we kind of, at that time, swung hard to the left, because after Humphrey, we had McGovern ran in 72, and then Nixon beat McGovern handedly, because the country still was showing, and it took the 70s and 80s for us to get to where we are now. I bring that up because that was done, and what was disconcerting for our movement is that we allowed them to run the same playbook they ran 50 years ago. And so because of that, we should have learned, and I think that our goal now for our movement is to say that, well, we don't want to make the same mistake they made in 70 and 72. And at that time, it was very powerful. They had the people went to Gary, Indiana. They had the Black Political Convention. They had, I mean, they were organizing. Right. So there were some great things that came out of the Nixon that we will now see out of Trump. People now ready to organize, which we should look at. But I think that was a clear takeaway that this effort by Trump is actually an effort that was done before. Now, with that being said, the power of the people and their ability to continue to organize, be personally being down in Standing Rock, that changed me, Eugene, because that right there was such a powerful example of us using everything in our toolbox to fight against organized money.
Right.
And if there's ever a situation where you can see organized people beating organized money, it was Standing Rock. And I think that provides a blueprint for us moving forward in 2017 and beyond.
I think that's a great point. I'm actually glad that you brought that up, too, because I've been asking a lot of different folks we've had on the show who have been in and out of Standing Rock. I mean, it seems that, you know, to some degree, the answer to some of our questions are there. I mean, after the election, the big question people were raising, well, how do we build a movement that embraces all different kinds of people with leadership coming from oppressed communities, recognizing all these things? And it seemed like, okay, we're having this conversation. It's an important conversation, but it seemed totally abstracted from the fact that here we have Standing Rock, a struggle that was led by Native people, but that had everyone from every progressive sector rally to it, Black forces, Latino forces, the environmental movement, and all those voices were heard in a way that never subordinated the reality of the Native American struggle, that never disconnected these issues from all the issues that other folks were bringing. And it just sort of seemed like, man, this is powerful. So, I mean, what are some of those organizing lessons, do you think, that we can move forward? I mean, if we can beat $10 billion in invested money there, it seems like there's something we should be looking into.
Well, one of the things is that money can't buy, which was faith. It was just an amazing level that they led everything in faith. I know we have different levels in our movement, those who are theists, those who are atheists, those who are Christian, those who are Muslim, across the board. But the one thing that was there was faith. It was a powerful, everything that they led that was done was led by prayer. And that was powerful. And I think that was something there that was a, if nothing else, it was a centering, it was a grounding effort. It was very powerful in Standing Rock. So that's the first thing. I think the second thing now that we begin to, I think movements being led by indigenous communities and being led by communities of color has merit and is needed. And I think that if we can invest and how we can create more movements that are not just led by, I'm not saying by a Black person or Black face in high place. I'm talking about that are truly grounded in the culture, truly grounded in the ethos of that community, truly grounded in what they are trying to accomplish and what their goal is, not your goal first. So the goal for Standing Rock was simply, many were showing, so water is life. And that was the basic line that, listen, these folks moved a pipeline that was going to Bismarck, which was a predominantly, you know, and we're saying a white town in North Dakota is kind of, you know, I think it is what it is. but it was what it was. But they moved it from there, and they moved it through the reservation. And so thinking that would be the path of least resistance. And so they were stunned, actually, by this community that they had beaten down. That rose up. That was the first thing that they rose up. And then I think that was by young people. And then elders only followed the young people. And so I think that what was needed is that for our movement, we have to allow for the indigenous community, people of color, young people to be leading and truly invest in that so that it's not really serious way of looking at it. And I think that was something that this movement was primarily a climate movement victory, and the climate movement has had some tremendous victories. But in that, I think that what was also a part of Standing Rock, they looked at something in which they were saying, listen, how do we take on the issue of the pipeline, but also connect that to the larger issue of transitioning from fossil fuels? And that was done very effectively. That allowed for more people to get on board. So while the bottom line response was water is life and how we need to stop this pipeline and also digging up sacred burial grounds, ultimately what it led to was that the black snake, as they called it, which was the pipeline, that leads to a path of destruction. They clearly stated that the companies that were investing in this pipeline and, in essence, fossil fuels, their business plan meant a death sentence to the people of Standing Rock and to future generations. And because of that, because their business plan was immoral, then we had the right to stand up to a business plan that meant a death sentence to our people and future generations. And because of that, other people then joined into that, because that same business plan, in effect, all over the planet and all over this country, would mean the same thing for us as well, which allowed them to organize and mobilize and energize people to come to Standing Rock and join in solidarity, which also is very important. People came to Standing Rock in solidarity. And a lot of times, these movements, people come to locations in charity. Mm-hmm. And we saw that in Flint, and we saw that after Superstorm Sandy. We saw it in Katrina. We see it all over, that a lot of times groups come in the spirit of charity. People say, well, Rand, what do you mean? Charity is a bit that's love, right? But no, charity is not solidarity. Solidarity means that if they die, I die. If they're being shot with rubber bullets, I'm being shot by rubber bullets. If they're being hosed by tear gas, I'm being hosed by tear gas. If their land is being dug up, my land is being dug up. And so it's a different mentality that you approach it when you come in the spirit of solidarity than in charity.
Mm-hmm. I think that's a great point. That's a very good point. And, you know, it makes me think about something else, too, which was, you know, I was looking at the Pew online poll about what people's, you know, the Clinton supporters and Trump supporters, what they thought about big issues in the wake of after the election was over. And, you know, as you might imagine, not that close on many issues. But the one issue that I thought was interesting is that both Clinton supporters and Trump supporters were pretty close in terms of how many, the percentage of, you know, somewhere between about 55-62% of people who said one of the very big problems in the country today was drug addiction. And I thought about that because I said, you know, so many of these Rust Belt communities that are just devastated by the economics, devastated by drug abuse. Then I think about so many of the quote-unquote inner cities devastated by economics, also devastated by drug abuse. I wonder if you could speak to the importance of cultural work, because it seems like in that point right there, there's a powerful linkage and at least jumping off point for a conversation between two communities that in many ways are polar opposites, but I think in their everyday lived experience might find a lot of things in common, but sort of getting to that point where people even willing to consider that can be tough. I mean, it's almost more cultural than political.
It is. No, it is very much more cultural than political. And I think that's where I think that a lot of the elites in Washington, D.C. in the bubble missed it, because they were fighting a political, they thought they were fighting something that was political, which actually was cultural. And that's why it's unfortunate that they missed it with particularly those on the left with Bernie Sanders. They had actually seen that. They would have seen the cultural aspects to what Bernie was pushing forth, and that's an outcome would have been different or not. I don't know, but definitely I think that it would have had a big difference because of the connection. Now, the cultural aspect is two different aspects of culture. I think the cultural aspect is one, the cultural aspect of those who are born in these communities and what their culture means to them, what it means to be born in West Virginia, or in Ohio, or in Idaho, wherever. And there's a certain Judeo-Christian type of culture, whatever that means to them, kind of thing. And those communities, as you put quite well, are also being ravaged, up in New Hampshire, up in Vermont, by heroin, by drugs. And there are actually people who are dying now because of that. They're actually from gun violence. Mm. And so I think that they were being ravaged, and I think that was something that does connect them. And I think they were feeling that. Now, what's the disconnecting component between those two cultures is that while folks might be having the same problem in Chicago as they're having in Dubuque, the problem, they don't see themselves as the same, and they see themselves as different. Mm-hmm. And I think that even here, for those who are in the D.C. area, we see that. They might be having folks out of that same, having that problem with drugs. There was a huge drug bust out of Bethesda, Maryland. There was a huge drug ring that was in Frederick and Bethesda. People see that totally different somehow than what's happening in Southeast D.C. I don't know why they would see it differently, but they would see it totally different. Like, it was just a different, oh, my God, our children are caught in this drug ring, and they're on heroin. Well, people in Southeast were the same way. Mm. Our children get caught up And we're also very concerned, but they see it differently. And so I think that what we need to do is to figure out a way that unifies the culture. Now, this is what's very powerful. Young people, I think, have spoken very loudly. And I think at this election, young people were marching in the streets. Young people who couldn't even vote, who in high school were taking to the streets, which was very powerful. And I think young people on college campuses and throughout who weren't on college campuses, which is also very important, were definitely voicing their opinion that the future is being compromised, not only by what they thought for Hillary Clinton, but also by Donald Trump. And they felt that these two people were both either in their 70s or close to their 70s, didn't understand what it meant for those who are literally 50 or in some cases 60 years younger than them. And so what you're now seeing is young people who are saying that, listen, these folks won't be around. 30 years from now, Donald Trump probably won't be around. But what he's creating now as far as legislation and policy and how he's shaping policy will be around. So if I'm 20 now, if I'm 30, that means I'll either be 50 or 60. I'll be still young and vibrant, hopefully. But the policy that he's putting forth in regards to criminal justice, health care, regards to climate change, regards to all these things will have an adverse impact on me. And they recognize that. And in some cases, many young people are even suing the government in regards to climate change and in regards to criminal justice because they're saying that what you're doing now will have an impact on my livelihoods after you're gone. The reason I bring this up for that African culture, why it's so important, is that young people are now using their culture, their unified culture, either their music, their poetry, their way of connecting, their digital culture of using Facebook and Snapchat, all the way that they can communicate. They're now beginning to rise up. I think that's what's exciting. Actually, what was exciting about the Republic of 2017, that there is this unique culture of young people and people who are now utilizing culture to connect and not only get beyond this country, but even make it a global. So they're connecting with each other. So they're connecting with those on the continent of Africa and South America. They're connecting with those in all parts of North America and in Europe. So I think that you now have a new a dynamic in which the people are rising up. They are much more progressive. They want to see the change. And if they can hold out and cause enough stopgaps to this administration that is antiquated and old, then they can, they're literally fighting for their future.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, we got about a minute left until our first break, but I wanted to just pick up on that point right there, too. I mean, you know, we saw Standing Rock get a victory after this major civil disobedience was able to leverage so many other things. We've seen in the movement for Black Lives, I mean, whatever we think about sometimes the way people may cry out in pain, when these uprisings have happened in Baltimore and in Milwaukee, we've seen people, you know, make some moves at the legislative level. I mean, how much when we connect these sort of facts do we have to remember that really disrupting the system is the way our voice is going to be heard in the unfiltered way, not mediated through whoever it may be.
That's it. I think demonstration is critical, and I think that we must continue that. But saying that, demonstration without legislation or demonstration without litigation leads to frustration. Mm. And so we have to also recognize how we can join these things together, about how we use demonstration, but then how we then also shape legislation and in some cases go to litigation so that we don't have that frustration. Mm-hmm. I think that's where we are now.
I think that's a great point. We're going to take a break on that. We're going to come back with more with Reverend Lennox Yearwood from the Hip Hop Caucus here on By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Eugene Perrier. Stay with us.
By any means necessary.
Welcome back to By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Eugene Perrier, and as always, we're your guide to connecting the political, social, and economic movements shaping the world around us. And today we are continuing our conversation with the Reverend Lennox Yearwood, who's the president and CEO of the Hip Hop Caucus, about a little bit in the year past and a little bit what we can take from that into the next year to push things in a more progressive direction. And Reverend Yearwood, before we leave this issue of culture, I just wanted to address it in a different way. I mean, this is a big part of what you guys do at the Hip Hop Caucus. You sort of bridging the gap between spaces that I think often are deliberately kept apart in the entertainment, sports world, and the political world. And you know, I just thought to myself, because obviously I'm a big fan of your work, but towards the end of the campaign, Hillary Clinton, you know, she's bringing out all these artists and entertainers and athletes to come out and say things. And, you know, hey, whatever, fine. But I was saying to people that to me, it almost felt like that backfired in a way because it struck so much as pandering. But when you saw something like a Killer Mike or someone like that come out for Bernie Sanders, which like caught me off guard, it had like a bigger impact because it seemed like, okay, well, he must really believe this because I can't, obviously this brother is not going to make any money off this. So there must be something behind it. And I mean, talk a little bit about the difference between sort of the important work of really developing sort of that movement culture and infrastructure that combines all these different elements of our lived life. I mean, you know, I watch football, listen to music, and go to protests in a way that makes sense. Because to me, it seems like people just want to jump on it and say, I got my hip hop box checked, but it's not really, you know, engaging with the culture in a real way.
No, thank you for that, actually. I think it's actually, I mean, it's ironic. I sometimes don't speak enough about the work that we do at the Hip Hop Caucus and what that has meant politically. One, I think that as a hip-hop caucus, I think for those who are listening, hip-hop caucus was created, man, now almost 12 and a half years ago. It was actually the consolidation and merger of some other hip-hop organizations that were happening and at the time. And there were some that were kind of led by activists. There was actually a hip-hop political convention that was going on. And also there was some that were led by artists. And the hip-hop caucus was created back in actually 2004, September 11th, 2004. And it was created as to be more of a political voice that can kind of unify, but and also that it was that while it understood the importance of having celebrities, it also understood that we need to have a grassroots component. So my job was then to kind of take this effort and then how you work with celebrities and their whole world that they live in, and then also work with grassroots and then clearly being much more of a progressive organization. And so that's what we've done. And some things have shaped us along the way. Clearly, the issue of police reform, police accountability, has shaped us way back when we were talking about Deontay Rawlings in Washington, D.C., and Sean Bell, leading up to Tyrone Martin, Oscar Grant, and so many others that led up to Black Lives Matter. And even before that, Katrina was kind of led us into our issues regarding environmental justice and the climate emergency. And then clearly education, and then our war, our stance on peace. I mean, clearly we have been very much vocal on against torture, closing Guantanamo. We have gone actually to Jordan and to the Middle East and been with those who are refugees, either from the many wars that we have had. We've had tours. We have our tour. We have Make Hip Hop That War. But Hip Hop Caucus is unique. We have a lot of different artists, right? We have artists who are in there who are like, I just was with last week in Moral Technique, who's amazing. But I have other artists in Hip Hop Caucus who's hip hop that are in the trap music, that are straight, you know. I mean
y'all had 2 Chainz dude putting in work for you.
We have 2 Chainz. So, but that's my world. So I have to kind of, what we have to do is how do I blend those worlds together? I think I've done okay job at that. I'm really trying to blend those worlds, all those worlds together, so that at least at the core, if somebody is sometimes really more conscious, like if I have a Distillery X or a Moral Technique or I have whoever on that side, then it makes it easier than I work with other artists, but the campaigns are the same. So we've had, for our voting campaign, you know, our initial voting campaign, which we came into this, was either both our hip hop summits, which was one, and Vote or Die. And then those actually merged into Hip Hop Caucus, which we passed over. And then we came with the Respect My Vote campaign. It's important to note that our campaign is nonpartisan and actually postpartisan. And that's important because we don't endorse candidates. Our Respect My Vote campaign came into play when Barack Obama was running for office. We didn't endorse Barack Obama. And we didn't support. In other words, we didn't, like, coordinate with them. And I think that's why a lot of groups messed up, because they were so ready, because they were like, it didn't seem like, okay, you're in the politics. Because for us, we have folks who are in the caucus, who are either Republican, Democrat, Green Party, Independent, right, Socialist, Communist. And so we have everybody who's in the part of the caucus. So being that the case, then, you know, we can't really be going with. So that's important. The core issue of our Respect My Vote campaign is that you got to respect our vote. And you respect us and our process. And then clearly one of the other things, too, is how do we get those who are most marginalized in our community? So we're looking for ex-offenders, how we, you know, get them on the rolls and help them to vote, which was the key. So that's actually how we missed the T change. So each one of the campaigns has been led with a celebrity who has been an ex-offender. And we've also found out, you know, in the culture, that when people see somebody who's kind of, you know, put a celebrity, but it's from their community, the ex-offender, they will support that person. So actually, we left with T.I. T.I. actually was our first one, and actually was in 2000. And I want to say that, too, because T.I., if you watch T.I. now, people always come to me and they say, oh, man, Red, you work with these artists. I work with artists from all ilks. But how do I allow for the Cassius Clays to become the Muhammad Ali's? How does that happen if they're not around us? How do we create our bubble? Like, we're all right. We got all the answers, but we don't allow folks who can come in and clearly they like, man, I'm with you on this, but you know, and they just come out, they want to come in. How do we allow for our Fannie Lou Hamers to be part of our movement in the 21st century? And so for me, that's what's in place. So T.I. now, about people know his last album that came up with was super dope, is All Conscious. But that starts because he was with us in 2008. And so over this past 8 years, being with the Hip Hop Caucus, you can now see the transformation. Now, I'm not saying that has to happen. Not all artists who are involved with Hip Hop Caucus in transform at all.
Right.
So, and that's what it is. But it is good to see a T.I. or last time, an artist who was incarcerated, ex-offender, was 2 Chainz, and then this year, leading off with Charlamagne Tha God. And all of them had been ex-offenders, and so they all had their platforms. They're all very different, but we want to use them. But then, furthermore, having artists that I can look at, clearly we've always had Thomas, always been involved, and that's great, but artists like Vic Mensa, you know, I'm so excited about like artists like him, who are from Chicago, got an amazing song called 16 Shots, was taken out of Laquan McDonald, but also, you know, was in Standing Rock, was with me down in Baton Rouge with Alton Sterling, you know, so they're amongst the people. And many of the artists now are moving in that lane, Chance the Rapper and others. Now, what happens here, to your point, was like, well, then how do they end up just kind of going with a candidate, you know, either with Bernie, with pulling my part of the Hip Hop Caucus, or with Hillary. You know, a lot of times this is the part. The Hip Hop Caucus will tell them, listen, you can endorse who you want to endorse, but if you do anything regarding Hip Hop Caucus, you have to be very straightforward on that. Not because we're not against the candidate, I'm not saying we're for or against. Mm-hmm. It's just that even when they get elected, like when Barack got elected, and he was still slow on the crack cocaine disparity issues, or slow on other issues, then we also want to be there to hold them accountable. Our job is to fight for the people, not the politician.
Right.
And so, at the end of the day, you know, I think as the Hip Hop Caucus grows, which we are, growing now in 21 cities, Hip Hop Caucus in 21 cities across the country, Hip Hop Caucus Baltimore, Hip Hop Caucus Detroit, Hip Hop Caucus LA, I think as we continue to grow as an organization, I think and hope that more artists will kind of stick along with the company line, so to speak, and invest in our own power. And I think that eventually, hopefully, we can even begin to, you know, we're not there yet, but I think even begin to create a cultivation for people who want to run. We don't have that structure yet to do that, but I'm hopeful that at some point in time, as we're growing people through our movement, through our cities, or even through artists, that at some point in time, like yourself, I know when you ran, it was amazing, an amazing run. I think that we need that because even in running sometimes, I can at least put out certain images and things out there that need to be discussed in the public square.
Mm-hmm. No, absolutely. I think that's a great point. I'm glad you brought up the Vic Mensa thing because I was actually looking at on you guys' Twitter some of the statements he had been making on his own, and I'm like, I don't know, they got next to this brother because he's saying some unbelievable stuff, some powerful stuff, and it's one of those things that I think you're entirely correct about the strategy too. I mean, it reminds me of something I saw at Milton Friedman, someone on the other side of things, but he made a statement in the mid '70s that was very interesting, and he said, you know, I don't really focus focus on candidates per se. Like, there's candidates I like, candidates I don't like. But he was like, what's really bigger than the individual candidate is setting the terms of the debate. Like, if all the people, right, no matter who they are, like, well, look, I can't go there because I know, you know, the 85 million fans of these 20 artists are all down with divesting from fossil fuels. So let me just get on board with that ahead of time. You often, you know, you set the debate. You're not sort of responding or negotiating with someone about your support. You just set the terms for the debate. And it almost seems like that's where we need to start thinking.
I agree. No, I mean, that's exactly it. But I think so. One of the areas we've been working on, she kind of mentioned divest. You know, we have been very big ever since Katrina. We have really been big in the climate movement. And I think that was important to us because, one, we involved a lot of different areas. But when we got involved with that, we realized that, man, we have a very segregated progressive movement. My God, is that we can just see the silos. Like, you go to one rally, there's immigration, there's all the brown people. You go to one LGBTQ rally, there's people who are LGBTQ. You know, one rally is Black Lives Matter, just people who are black or primarily people who are dealing with that issue. And so it was like, man, we will not be successful if we have this kind of siloed progressive, even segregated progressive movement. And so for us, we begin to break down. So we get with the climate movement. They're like, oh, that's great. You guys be a great environmental justice movement. I said, well, yeah, we fight environmental justice. That's what we're in for. Clearly, that's what we're about. But we also want to be with the larger discussion. And I think that that was a key thing. And I think that with artists that we're bringing into the movement that we get to be around, I mean, you mentioned Vic Mensa. I mean, clearly, this is a rock nation. This is Jay-Z's, one of Jay-Z's main artists. He is managed by Scooter Braun. If people don't know Scooter Braun, Scooter Braun is, man, I forgot his name. He is the manager for all the major artists out in the game.
Mm-hmm.
And in that process, he's mainstream. So Vic Mensa is about as mainstream as you can get. So with that, to have him and others who are now coming up and speaking the way he's speaking up, I think that this is one of the things that actually makes us so excited for 2017 and beyond.
No, I think it's a great point. And I want to swing back around to another piece that I think we're going to need to focus on. It's something that I know that you've also been very outspoken on. The first issue that I think ever brought us together, you know, the issue of the military industrial complex relationship to the investment in our own communities that Dr. King pointed out so heavily. I mean, we've seen so many stories this year, $6 trillion that the Pentagon couldn't account for, $125 billion in waste, the F-35 that even Donald Trump is like, this is a huge waste of money. I mean, it seems like perhaps with all of this stuff coming out in 2016, in 2017, it's a great time for us to refocus on this issue of we can't talk about, you know, rebuilding a community if we also can't talk about the fact that so much of this money that's out there is just being leaked away in these destructive weapons projects.
I mean, I agree. Let me just say this. I mean, I think that this is the one area that I think that we have to look at. Clearly, Dr. King said it back, that the bombs that are dropping overseas aren't asking the bombs that are dropping in our own communities because of resources and infrastructure is not coming to us. I would say this. I think that, you know, there's a lot of reasons why we aren't dealing with that. And I think that this is something that for those of us in a new generation, I'm almost shocked sometimes at how people of color aren't in the peace movement.
Mm.
Per se. I mean, I just want to bring up one of our great ones, Damu Smith.
Yes.
You know, who definitely was someone who understood, one, about how you break down those silos and connect the dots, but was a real one, as they were saying, mm-hmm. in this work. But I just say that, man, you know, I think that, you know, when Donald Trump is saying that something is too much money, I mean, that alone should let you know. And this occurred during Barack, right? These are the kind of things that when we look back, there will be a lot of things that we're going to be like, man, you know, President Obama, there's a lot of stuff you just let go that, you know, you should have been more on the ball with. And I definitely think in regards to the military, I definitely think in regards to his use of drones, I definitely think in regards to how he has what happened with Secretary Clinton in regards to Libya and parts of the Middle East was just wrong. It was wrong. And I think that we as people of color particularly should be more outraged, particularly at this almost the racism that goes into the international policy and how that's utilized against people of color primarily across the globe. And I think that we have to do a much better job of people of color in this country with our ability to speak out and speak up and using the Constitution as that measure so that we can have that free speech, so to speak, and an ability to make sure that we are being heard. And I think that that will continue for us. We, you know, that's, the caucus is still very much on that lens. We have still been, we're still pretty much a peace organization that still trumps the issue of no war, no warming to some degree, and other issues that we need to connect together. And, you know, for me, it's also important because for your listeners, I mean, I was in the military. I was actually an officer in the Air Force. And so, you know, I spoke out at peril. I mean, you know, while I was actually in there.
Right.
So, you know, I understand the machine, but also understand that when you have to stand up for justice, particularly when something is wrong, you must do that. And I think that's one of the key things there that I would hope. Now, I'll also say this. This is kind of a harsh one. I think that a lot of our civil rights organizations are too connected to a lot of the things that are hurting our community.
Mm.
And we need to divest from a number of these things, particularly from the military industrial complex. We need to invest from the fossil fuel industrial complex and definitely from the prison industrial complex. I think that when I go around to too many conferences around and I see our sort of organizations, I see them being sponsored by too many of these industrial complexes that are hurting our people. And they got to just kind of figure out a way to stop taking that money. I get it. I mean, I get it. You know, I want to organize it too, but it's just wrong. It's just wrong. And you just got to figure out a way because that mutes your voice. And I think in the words of Shirley Chisholm, I think that, you know, that how you can be unbought. And I think a lot of times when we're wondering why people aren't speaking up against the military industrial complex or against the fossil fuel industrial complex or against the prison industrial complex is because they pretty much paid for our silence.
Mm.
And I think that a lot of these groups are going to have to really break that. I think that we're going to be holding more of the institutions that are supposed to be forced, either churches or civil rights organizations or even progressive organizations. We got to hold you accountable because if you're in that position, then you're actually leading the people wrong because they're wondering why when we get to the victory line, why we don't cross? But damn, we got to the victory line. We got right there.
Mm.
And why didn't we cross? And they're wondering why. A lot of times because you're cutting the backroom deals and you're doing things, and that really should not be the case. And so that's one of the things I would hope that we move forward, particularly on the issues of the military industrial complex that exists, that's real, that will probably get worse, that we have to speak out against that. And I think that I'm hopeful that more organizations, you know, turn down those $5,000 or $6,000 checks that pay for right. a dinner and I think stand with the people. And I think that that has to happen as well.
Absolutely. Well, and I appreciate it. That's going to be all the time we have today. Go to hiphopcaucus.org and check out all of the great work of the Hip Hop Caucus and Reverend Lennox Yearwood, their president and CEO. That is going to do it for By Any Means Necessary here today on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Eugene Puryear. See you next time.
By any means necessary.